this is the sort of the setting, which is a lot of attention has been paid, as you know, if you're an instructor, to various connectivity issues and so on. And but we have to face the reality that many of our students are going to be in very difficult personal situations. Think, for example, how many of our students are in the New York City area. And they're going to be surrounded by illness, perhaps grief, perhaps a parent who lost their job. And the question is, that you would, I think anyone would sort of ask, how can you learn in that kind of environment? So we have here several expert counselors and so on who can help us with this, these sorts of issues. But before I go any further, let me just sort of remind you that this is recorded and the audio will be posted. And Nima, would you like to say something before we get started?
Yeah, so thank you everyone for coming on, and thanks to Reba and Wei and Zebediah for joining us today. Just as a reminder, if you want, we typically, because this is might be a larger forum, we mute all the participants, but please send us your comments and questions via the chat box, and Jill will read them out to the group, and then we will have Reba, Wei, and Zebediah sort of respond, and then Charlie and I will add anything else that we know from our various, from the various conversations we've been having. If you have something that you'd like to add to what is being talked about, again, please use the comment box, and Jill will read those out. So thank you. Thank you again for joining us.
So let me start. Reba, are you there?
Oh. Yes, I am here. Hello.
Okay, very good. So maybe tell us a little bit about your job and what sort of, and I'm sort of thinking in the following ways, that faculty are going to have to perhaps on occasion be grief counselors, and you guys are the experts. I'd like to sort of know the kinds of advice that faculty can give in these sorts of situations. And do we are we set up where a faculty member can refer a student to someone in Cornell Health? So anyway, why don't just do a little stream of consciousness. Tell us what maybe you're thinking about this scene, what it's going to be like, say, 2 weeks from now when the peak hits in New York City, for example. What sort of things are we going to see, and how can we handle it?
That's a lot of questions. I'll try to do my best in answering all of them. So thank you for having me. My name is Reba McCutcheon. A little bit about my role. I'm an associate dean of students, and I serve on the Care and Crisis Services team through the Dean of Students Office. Care and Crisis Services includes a lot of things. I do work very closely with Zebediah and Wei. Hi, guys. And we are a team. Right now we're tracking a lot of the isolation cases as students are tested and then await those results. And I'm also the advisor of Cornell Minds Matter and new today, EARS. And so I do have a lot of contact with primarily the undergraduate students. One of the things that I'm hearing a lot of is grief already. Grief in that they've lost their senior semester. They've lost the last chance to have, you know, there's no more slope day, there's no dragon. They've lost all of these momentous final senior things, events that they had been looking forward to. There's also some grief in that things are no longer normal. Well, for anyone. And when we lose that, when we lose something that was, we can go through a process of grief. We're grieving that. One thing I do think it's important for all of us working with students to really try to scratch at the surface and understand as best as we can is that the students that have remained here are isolated from their families. That's one thing. Students that have gone back to their families, many of them will be losing their student independent identity as they once again go back into their parents' home and are considered children. And that loss of identity is also another thing that students are grieving.
Those are very good points, and thank you. So Jill, as we go along here, if you can alert us to questions coming up on the chat board.
Right, nothing yet.
Wei, tell us a little, you're also in Cornell Health. Maybe tell us a little bit about your job and what you're seeing so far.
Sure, I'm Assistant Director for Community-Based Services over Cornell Health and CAHPS. You know, right now what we're doing, we're scrambling to try to adjust to serving our students remotely, and we're trying to keep operations as normal as possible. So we have students who are who've been with us for a while and continue to need support, and as well as trying to accommodate new students who are coming in. And so, I imagine we're dealing with a combination of a lot of things that Reba already mentioned. I think there's a lot of shock, anger, grief, anxiety, a lot of isolation. A lot of students are going back to home environments that they thought they had gotten away from, which are not necessarily the healthiest for some of them, or at least makes them, a lot of them feel like they're going back and regressing. And a lot of them are going back to home situations that are, which are really unhealthy, and they're struggling with that and being separated from their peers. And so right now we're still taking students. We're no longer able to do online appointments as we were before. We're retooling that. But for now, if a student wants to see somebody, they just need to call us. And we have openings pretty much every day where students can be seen. And we're doing most of our sessions by telephone, but we're moving towards video. So hopefully in the next week or two, those of us who have good enough internet connections will be able to start doing video chats with our students. So we're working through a lot of those things. And we're also ironing out psychiatry and how to do psychiatry services through telehealth. But again, a lot of the issues that Reba spoke about are the things that we're seeing in addition to whatever else that they may have been dealing with before. Interestingly enough, in some ways, some of our students are actually doing better. Some of them have actually experienced this as a pause, you know, but probably the majority of them are experiencing a lot of shock. We're seeing a lot of graduating seniors, you know, whose plans and hopes and, you know, all of those things have been kind of quashed. So dealing with a lot of loss and a lot of fear. You know, we have a lot of students with anxiety issues already, you know, and this certainly has put kerosene in a lot of their anxiety. And in addition, a lot of the students are dealing with job search, with graduating seniors and such. You know, and some of them have seen some of their offers being reneged, and some of them who are entering the job market are just absolutely terrified about what they'll be facing after they graduate. And so I think they're adjusting to those issues as well.
Thank you. Just to clarify, because I know you, in normal times, you have different ways of contacting and interacting with students. So the phone side of the operation stays the same, and mm-hmm. you're working to have a more video interaction as a replacement for face-to-face.
Right. So we're all working from home for the most part.
Okay.
And so there are a lot of technical issues, and we're trying to do a video platform that's HIPAA compliant that ensures confidentiality. And I think a lot of our counselors are dealing with technical issues. A lot of us sort of like live far away from town and our internet connections aren't the best.
Right.
And so some of us may continue to do telephone visits. Those of us who have better internet connections will probably move towards video soon.
Thank you.
Question.
Wait, let me go to Zebediah, yep. Then we'll do questions. Zebediah, Zeb is the director of Student Disability Service. And again, Zeb, maybe you give a little overview of your job and what you're seeing so far. And later we'll, of course, have specific questions concerning students with disabilities.
Yes, as Charlie stated, Director of Student Disability Services. One of the things that is talked about a lot is accessibility from a online platform standpoint. And so most of the time when we're thinking about that, we're thinking about it from a standpoint of somebody being hearing impaired or somebody being visually impaired. And so to piggyback off what Wei said and what Reba said, I want us to open our mind from a standpoint of when we talk about anxiety, the opposite of anxiety is trust. And so we're in unprecedented times, so everybody's lacking trust. And so when we're thinking about how can we accommodate students, how can we calm them in such a way by giving them structure? When we're talking about students are going home, some students are going home to a one-bedroom environment where their family has to utilize the internet as well, so they can't get on at the same time as a synchronized class can be. We are dealing with it from a standpoint of trying to work with faculty for them to understand that students that need certain accommodations, we already reached out to those specific faculty members. And we want to make faculty know that we're here to support them. But the understanding of what we're going through is we don't know what it's going to look like next week. And we don't know what it's going to look like a week from now. And so the best thing we can do is have flexibility and understanding, because everybody's going through different situations. Now I'll kind of pause there. We can get into a little bit more, but I just really want to emphasize the opposite of anxiety is trust. And so as we thinking about calming our students, that's not necessarily it. How can we reinforce trust to our students?
Zebediah, can you just briefly talk about how, so your staff, I assume, is at home and think of the normal way of doing business, students coming around, talking to you. Will there be a video version of that? People can schedule appointments. What does that scene sort of look like?
Our operations is kind of business as usual, except that we're not face-to-face. So we already have it set up where our students can do Zoom meetings. We can do phone appointments, things like that. We're actually thinking about holding some open office hours for faculty to be able to pop in and have conversations with us as well. And so things is business as usual. They can go online, schedule appointments. And once again, for the students that receive accommodations already at the institution, we already reached out to those 2,400 students, and the accommodation letters have been given to faculty members as well. And so if there are specific things that need to go on, we are already in communication with faculty as well.
Okay, thanks an awful lot. Okay, Jill, how about question number one?
If students are at home but need help or just want to talk about a hostile environment, who should they contact?
So unmute all three of our...
They can unmute themselves.
Okay.
Well, again, CAPS is available for any student, and we have 24-hour coverage. So, in the middle of the night on the weekend, if they need to reach out and talk to somebody, I think, there's someone who's always available. And again, I think if they want to set up a regular appointment schedule or anything like that, we have daily openings at this point. Things aren't too full yet. So I would fully encourage those folks to do that.
Go ahead, Reba.
Thanks. I also just posted on the chat a list of resources with phone numbers. There's the National Crisis Text Hotline. There's a whole list of different resources, text lines, helplines, phone lines. Some are very specific to the LGBT community. Others are geared towards communities of color. So hopefully people can find a resource that works for them. At this time, the EARS peer-to-peer service is not happening, but the training for the trainers is still ongoing. So we anticipate being open whenever we're back in person again.
Could I add something? The University Ombudsman Service is available by email and Zoom. So if people are totally confused about where to go for anything, we're happy to try and be guides.
And I was just going to add to what Wei said. If students go through CAPS or they go through medical, medical is then going to notify SDS, and then SDS will then reach out to those faculty members to put accommodations in place. And so that's when I go back to the statement of being flexible. And so even if you can't get the student to necessarily want to go to CAPS, even if you get the students to reach out to us, we might be able to figure out some accommodations or some different ways we can interact and engage with those students academically.
And if I could just ask a follow-up question, I guess it's mostly for Wei and Reba. What happens when a student is in another country? How are we going to be thinking about that? How should we as faculty think about our international students who are, calling in from other places?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think in terms of CAP services, I think we would treat them the same. You know, I think the logistical problems, you know, just having discussion this morning about scheduling and time zones and things like that. Ideally, we'll try to connect them with local resources, you know, but again, I understand a lot of times, depending on where they're from, local resources may be either overwhelmed or unavailable, in which case I think we'll do our best to support them remotely. I think one of the challenges is that, you know, I mean, we're trying to make ourselves available, you know, but there are a lot of things that we just can't do or do as well, you know, calling from, you know, 3,000 miles away. But we'll try to be creative with them, you know, and connect them with whatever resources may be available.
Thank you.
And in terms of virtual programming, not necessarily for the acute, I need to speak with somebody now type of service. As Wei said, hopefully they would have some connections to the local services, but it, more in terms of the upstream mental health services, we are trying to get some virtual programs online. There is a new webpage, virtual engagement. I'll put that in the chat as well. So that's a helpful website, and the campus group's website will, the goal is that will become the one-stop shop for all of the events that are continuing virtually for the rest of this term.
Bill?
There are student petitions regarding various forms of pass-fail options.
Oh, we'll put that off to the end. That's you know, if we have time at the end for general questions. I mean, is that, sorry, does that segue into a
It doesn't seem to. It talks about addressing equity and stress issues with students. So do you want me to continue?
That's a real important topic, but I'd like to sort of to stick much more tightly to the
Okay.
There's, one second, Charlie. I think there's a connection. The connection is that the universal pass option would not just address an equity issue, but it would address a stress issue, right? And so if one removes a certain kind of sort of stress the students are facing and allows students to feel it's about fairness and trust, that everybody is being taken into consideration, what would it be like? So if I understand the question is from Risa, right, it's that's what it's trying to say. Risa Nadia, yeah, okay. And so we should not take, I would be interested in hearing from Reba, Wei, and Zebediah about the stress issue. Does it, you know, in any way, how does it impact that?
I mean, I agree. I think Zebediah already alluded to this earlier. I think students' home environments vary a lot. You know, not all of them have equal access to the internet. Some of them don't have private space to study. Some of them have chaotic home environments. And again, I think a lot of them are dealing with a lot more stress and anxiety than they would have been, you know, even if they were here. And I think we all know that, you know, excessive amounts of stress and anxiety can affect, you know, cognitive functioning, performance, and all that kind of thing. So I think, I mean, again, I think this is, you know, I don't want to stay in my lane here, you know, but I don't think it's unreasonable to take stress into account in terms of the expectations academically from the students. And again, I think some students, you know, are finding this situation quite easy to adjust to. And a lot of students are having a really difficult time, you know, for a variety of reasons. And they won't have the same kind of access or ability to perform at their best.
And what I would add, I think it would be no difference than us putting any other reasonable accommodation in place to interact the process. I think we got to be heavily include the faculty member throughout this whole entire process. I got to figure out what the structure of the class, what's actually being asked in comparison to what the student is articulating, what their actual stress is within the environments and the things that are at play. And so I think that for the classes that are not gonna go straight pass, fail, or SU, I think that's something that we can include student disability service in conjunction with CAPS to make an overall assessment. So we're making sure we're looking at this from a holistic point of view.
Now, add that the stress isn't just on the students, but as we are communicating and working with students, we also have to ask and assess where is the stress hitting us individually. because it is. We've never been through this before, of course. Any issues, you know, I thought my house was large enough. 2 weeks working remotely with my 9-year-old son and my spouse, it's not. So it's, you know, all joking aside, the stress is also hitting us, and that may impact how we respond to the students that are in stress, but it's, stress is a big one.
Thanks for pursuing this question, Nima. It was excellent. Jill.
If a student in Ithaca tells us that they and housemates probably have the virus, they are coughing, they've been exposed to a close friend who is positive, but they're doing isolation, not quarantine, and you cannot convince them to talk to the health center, is there anything more you can do besides keep in contact?
I guess I'll take the lead on this one. If the student is not getting tested, and at this point there are several testing options and availability, if the students are not getting tested, it makes it hard for us to support them as Care and Crisis Services and frankly as an institution. I would really encourage them to get tested, of course, but that's not the question. I would alert probably my office, the team in which I work, the Care and Crisis Services, and we can then maybe reach out to those students and assess how they are doing. And if we need to really outline again the isolation protocol, we're getting a lot of questions of, yes, I'm in isolation, but I can still go for a walk, right? No, not if you're waiting for that test result. No.
There is one question, Charlie. Is a version of this discussion going to take place with graduate students who are teaching FWSs?
Freshman writing seminars. We've taken steps, you know, it's easy for us to email the tenure track and RTE faculty. We're taking steps to make sure that that group, the grad students who are running freshman writing seminars, get all those emails, and same for the postdocs. So of course, when we post this, when we archive the audio for this, that's totally public.
Can I just ask, there's no privacy issue for me to go tell, no, she does not want me to tell anybody?
I'm sorry, I couldn't catch the first part of your question.
She told me, you know, she doesn't want anybody to know in the health center, but I can still go tell people. That was she said, please don't tell anybody. And I was like, I think I'll just contact her and say, I feel like I need to tell someone, or I don't have any issues where I'm not bound by her saying, please don't tell anybody.
Yeah, I don't think you're bound by any confidentiality or anything like that. So if you, in your judgment, you felt like it'd be good to contact us or somebody else, I mean, I think you're totally within your rights to do so.
I feel so because they're still going to grocery stores. So that's why I feel like I need to contact someone. Yeah. I'm worried about her, but I'm also worried by the fact that she's still going in public.
Yeah, a lot of students, I know they're not quite, it's not quite sinking in the full extent of what's going on, I think.
No?
So there was a thank you for this meeting. I'm concerned about my research student who is from China. I'm concerned she might be disrespected or feel that Americans are against her.
That's a good question. Are you seeing things like that in CAPS?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're hearing stories about that. You know, there have been some bias reports that have been filed along those lines. You know, there have been a number of articles written in like New York Times and things like that about sort of like anti-Chinese or anti-Asian incidents that's been happening. Yeah, I mean, I would totally validate those experiences. And again, at a time like this, you know, I would encourage them to report them if they feel comfortable. I mean, just to collate the information so that we gather in, as much data and stories as possible. But absolutely, this is happening. You know, there's a joke about coughing while Asian. You know, I think that's the, you know, I think people are living in fear, and I think people need an outlet for that fear, someone to blame. And unfortunately, I think certain public figures have encouraged that kind of thinking.
We are seeing this in our own community as well, some of the racial bias incidences. And it's hard to imagine that, you know, that happens in Ithaca, but we have seen it. And it's, we know again that the stress is really impacting everyone. So yes, absolutely, the validation for fears are real. And I think what we can do is, you know, stay kind. And
where
yes,
should they
report it?
Right, where should they report this?
There's a bias incident reporting link on the website. I'll find that and I'll put it in the chat as well.
I think it's also helpful to be really mindful about how that affects them academically. And where flexibility can come in, and not to harp on that situation, but I think flexibility is really important during those times.
And if I may just join in for a second, you know, so even before we started to ask students to go home, some of us had begun to see some, those of us who live in the residences at Cornell Emma House Dean had begun to know, have students reporting about sort of heightened levels of discomfort. And it's, you know, so part of it is about coughing and all of that that Wei raised. It's also about the wearing of masks, right? I mean, so it's not unlike wearing a hijab, that in Asian context, you wear a mask. It's, there's a whole, there's a fair amount of writing about the cultural context of it, why one does it, to protect somebody else. And here, of course, mask wearing, you know, we're discouraging it because it doesn't really help unless you are ill, and we want to be able to keep masks for medical personnel. And so there is that kind of tension also that's at play. And, you know, and I've had to field questions sometimes from very surprising, you know, folks that I would never expect wouldn't have understood that. So I don't think, you know, so it's a very different kind of bias and racism than we're typically used to in the United States. And so something quite important, I think, for all of us faculty to be quite aware about.
Thank you.
Do you have any specific suggestions about what faculty can do to lessen stress for our students? I have recast my reading list, entirely rewritten my assignments, and remind them that they can change to pass-fail. But much of their stress is located outside of my class. What can I offer them, for example, if they're at home and not out to their family, or out in a hostile environment, both of which have come up with my students?
Well, one of the things I would suggest is starting to reframe their mind around short-term goals. And so as we think about long-term goals, let's think about short-term goals to get them. Maybe as we think about, let's get through to the semester, let's break it down and let's get through the week. And then maybe let's get through the day. And then if the day is too much, let's get through some hours. It depends on what's really going on with those individuals. Even though it's not academically, how you can help academically is really clear-cut communication, whether that's in Canvas, whether that's in email. If you can organize your thoughts all in the same kind of way with all of your communication where there's structure, that would be really, really helpful. One of the things that I'm really trying to promote to have faculty help students in different situations, if you're given an overall concept, if you can give that overall concept like a TED Talk in 15 to 20 minute video, it's easier for us to go back to make it accessible, but it's also easier for faculty to get their pace and their pitch. If you're trying to teach a specific concept, make that concept 5 to 10 minutes long, because the normal person attention span is about 10 minutes. And so when students are struggling and they're in stressful environments, if they can get to short increments of the access to the material, could also be helpful overall to even help them digest the material and break up the monotony of what they're actually dealing with. And so there are some things you can do academically to help structure that environment. And some of those students are going through different things. And so if we can give them short-term goals, start with a month, start with a week, start with a day, depending on what they're going through.
Thank you.
I mean, I think there are a lot of concrete things that you can probably find online or we can talk about here. But I think it really helps to start by being human, because I think one thing that's unique about this is that we're all going through it. I mean, you know, we're going through it in many ways alongside our students as well. And I think being real and being human with them can be very helpful to know that their professors, you know, whom they admire and look up to, might be experiencing some similar anxieties and fears and struggles that they might be. I think it can really humanize the whole process. I can sort of destigmatize them and maybe sort of normalize it for them. So I think as a rule of thumb too, I think that's very helpful. This is me personally. I don't feel like I need to be, you know, the expert on this. I'm no expert on this. I mean, this is the first time I've gone through a pandemic. I don't know about anybody else, you know? I think just talking to them. Yeah. You know, I'm going through the same thing. You know, I'm oftentimes as lost and as bewildered and as frightened as you are. And that's okay. That's human, you know? And sort of diffuse that, you know, and make it okay. And then there's some situations, you know, like I think whoever asked this question alluded to.
It's me.
There's some students whose identities are out and open here. And when they go back to their home environment, you know, there are varying degrees of how okay that is. And that can be incredibly stifling. You talk about isolation, you talk about, you know, feeling constrained and trapped. I mean, I think students can feel trapped on multiple levels, not just physically. But many of them oftentimes are going home and all of a sudden, you know, they can be themselves here and back home. They have to put themselves back into this tiny little box and live in fear. And again, I don't think there's anything concrete we can do to help with that situation per se. But I think to the degree that we can, you know, just validate that and you know, be human beings with them, I think that can help.
Can I just follow up for a second? I was the one who asked this question, and it's particularly salient in my teaching right at this moment because I'm teaching an intro to LGBT class. And I was fortunate enough to have one class session after it became clear we were going to shut down, but before everybody had to leave. And so I did just that. I asked them how they were feeling and what their stresses were. And these were two of the responses of the many, many, many things they were worried about. But maybe this is really more a question about me. It's a selfish question. Like, I have done all this work academically to recast my class, but I'm just worried about some of them. You know, like, they're isolated, they're at home in small towns. You know, they have talked to me about feeling like they don't have a network. You know, they've come out, they've made their life being out here, as you said, Wei, and I just would like to be able to offer them. I mean, I think the breaking it down into smaller chunks is a really helpful suggestion, so thank you very much. But I am just trying to figure out ways to help them just get through it, I think.
It's like you're describing students that have come out, so now they're butterflies, and now they have to go back home and kind of force themselves back into their cocoon. And that's painful. And I think, Kate, what you're doing, and it sounds like you've already done, is creating a space where students can approach you and talk to you about those issues. And creating that space and having, you know, if I know that I can go to my professor and talk about this without judgment, without, you know, fear, and that there is a non-judgmental space for someone to actually listen, you know, as Wei said, you know, to be human on that really, you know, crucial level, creating that space is helpful. We also know that referrals from a trusted source are the most helpful. So you creating that space and being that trusted source, you can make those referrals to the Steve, texting, that's the one for the LGBT support. I hope that helps. It's painful.
Thank you very much.
Jill?
There was a question back that asked, do we know how many students decided to stay in Ithaca?
I can do a real quick math thing, which I think there's 6,000 in the dorms, and I think we're down to like less than a couple of hundred, but that leaves another like 7,000 or 8,000 undergraduates that I would sort of assume are in apartments. So I would guess, again, no research here, I would guess at least half the undergraduate population is around.
We don't know how many have remained in their off-campus housing. We are running into challenges as the new testing sites are very open. Students that live off campus are getting tested and then they're coming back and then we just don't know. So we don't know how to support them. We don't know. But thankfully we do have a handle on the on-campus undergraduate numbers.
Thank you. There are no questions currently.
I got one. So yeah, you know when you're advising and a student gets discouraged and you sort of give a pep talk and you know, you can do it. And I'm just wondering, you know, if a student, if faculty is interacting with a student and maybe the student is sort of really thinking, I just can't handle it anymore. And can you give guidance about how do you read that? How do you know when it's really across the line and it's, it's not just a question of, a pep talk and encouragement that maybe the student really can't finish. How do we look at that line? Somebody please.
Can you clarify like what you mean? Like which line are you talking about?
You want to be encouraging, right? A student comes in and talks to you about difficulties and you want to be encouraging. But is there such a thing as being too encouraging that maybe the student really is in such a difficult position that being a little bit too proactive with encouragement may not be a healthy thing? I've seen things in normal times where you encourage a student to stick it out and then it really was a mistake in retrospect. And you felt, well, you know, I should have let the student drop, or it would have been better if the student dropped. That's kind of what I'm talking about.
Well, I think one scenario is where the student, you know, just for whatever reason feels unacceptable to drop, you know, that they see it as a failure on their part, or it's a personal failure, it's a moral failure, or something like that. And I guess in a scenario like that, I would just say, you know, it's okay. You know, it's okay. This is really hard. And I totally get it. If you can't finish this course, you can't do this project. You know, let's look at some of the options, you know, do you have enough equity to do an incomplete, or can you drop the course? But again, I think they sort of decatastrophize it, because oftentimes students will feel a lot of shame around that, or they'll think, you know, there'll be some catastrophic consequence. And I think to the degree that we can diffuse both the shame and the catastrophic consequences that they may have in their mind, I think it may allow them to sort of like free up their thinking a little bit to look more realistically what their options are. Because you're right, sometimes realistically, you know, it's just not going to happen. You know, it's just not realistic for a student to complete, you know, whatever it is. And then that's okay. You know, it's all right. It's human. You know, it happens. And especially now, I mean, you know, I would say who would blame you?
And I would just say that's going back for me to that flexibility piece of let's not be right, but let's do the right thing. And so we might be past certain deadlines. We might be past certain things we typically wouldn't do, but this is not typical times. And so if we're past a deadline that doesn't allow incomplete or doesn't allow a certain thing because they're not at 70% or 50% of the course completed already to get it incomplete, let's be flexible on our guidelines and let's do the right thing and let's not be right.
I would say that we treat it like we treat students who have accommodations, and that same of flexibility, we might treat a student who's disabled, or that we look at them that way, where we think carefully about, you know, say someone had been sick that semester, and we wouldn't pressure a student who was, you know, who had, you know, a very serious injury. We would think twice about pressuring. We see a student who's under serious stress, we would treat them the same way. So I think we think about how we would treat a student who, you know, had gone out because they had, you know, been in a serious car crash or had suffered a death in the family, and we just relate to them that same way.
Jill?
For students who may be newly experiencing financial insecurity, such as when a parent has lost a job, do we have special contact individuals within financial aid or other resources to consult?
I can start with that one. There is the Access Fund, which has, they've already processed about 1,000 applications, primarily working with paying for travel or assisting financially with travel for students to get home that otherwise could not do it. Other ways that they've helped, other applications are for students that don't have Wi-Fi at their home, they don't have a laptop at home. They're being very generous with the Access Fund. A lot of the student organizations that receive the Byline funding, such as EARS and Cornell Minds Matter, are giving the bulk of their spring semester budget back to the student assembly for specifically the Access Fund. So that's one place. In terms of a point person for financial aid, there is the Students Helping Students application, but emailing just directly, I don't know of an individual person, but emailing findaid@cornell.edu and asking for that would be helpful as well.
And I would just say on our end, certain students that we did things for as it relates to accommodations, we're still paying for those things. So if there were certain students that had print accommodations, we're figuring out ways they can either print in their hometown or we can print and send material. For students that due to our loan or laptop, we're still sending those to individuals. People that use hearing devices, we're still doing all those same things. We're just mailing it. And so sometimes it just might take a little longer, but we're still doing the same things in SDS.
There was a comment that I like Zebediah's advice to break things down into manageable chunks. We're all trying to approach the completion of spring semester as a manageable chunk in various ways. Does anyone know whether Cornell knows at what point we will have a decision whether to continue remote teaching in fall 2020?
No one knows. I mean, you've only, it's been, you know, like commencement is been put off and so on. I think that decision is going to have to come in early summer, right? I mean, we, and the two levels of it, one is say it's okay for domestic students to get here, but the international students can't because the consulates haven't opened up enough and so on. So there are different levels to that. But I would say, one can't even begin to estimate that for, you know, probably at least 2 months, right?
Charlie's last question about student stress relates to my question about whether Cornell should consider having a pass-fail approach to everyone or a universal pass approach. The stress plus equity issues are the reasons some universities have adopted this policy for everyone. Should the Faculty Senate consider this too?
So we have SU optional for students, and Nima can speak about the arguments that are concerns about that that option. And maybe Nima should do that, and we can certainly talk about that. We haven't, we're going to have a virtual Senate meeting in a week from at the regular time. We haven't organized that too well, but senators can certainly bring up any resolution or propose a resolution that they want. The trouble is that the meeting comes after the start of classes, which maybe not be a relevant fact. But Nima, why don't you speak to that tension that we see in the SU discussion arena?
So for those of you who are interested in this question. It's an ongoing conversation, and there was a fair amount of thought put into Cornell's decision to have a what they call a student-centered approach, and some other universities, Carnegie Mellon, for example, is following the same approach. And the idea is that it allows a student to make a decision, that it's sort of humane, and that it allows a student to make a decision about whether they want to have their class be SU or to be able to take it for grade. I think we've also allowed, correct me if I'm wrong, Reba and Wei and Zebediah, I think we're also allowing a certain period of time after you finish the semester, after you finish your classes, where you can still opt for an SU grade. I may be wrong about that. But the idea of allowing people for grade is because the university was hearing a lot from people and parents who were sending in letters arguing for keeping the grade option because they're worried about the impact of it on future educational prospects, right? So they're worried about what it means if they want to go to med school or law school or whatever. And so that's a big concern for a lot of our students. And so that's been an issue that the university is trying to be responsive to. So those are the arguments for keeping the SU and the arguments for making it optional and for keeping grade and SU. And the arguments for removing it and having a universal pass structure, which again, many of our peers have done, have been articulated already, I think, by Zebediah, by Wei, and by Reba. So I won't go into that. It's an ongoing conversation. There is a student petition that's circulating, and I'm sure many of you would have seen it. My students sent it to me. There is a significant group of students who feel we should have a universal pass fail. There is a significant group of students who feel we should allow grades. And this is it, there's a real tension in it. And my own sense of it is from hearing both sides is that whatever we do, there's going to be a group of people who are unhappy with us.
Can I just ask, can somebody clarify whether there actually has been this, I think that would be a change to the issue of once grades are issued, that people can then have a period to decide whether to keep the grade or not. I had not heard that Cornell was doing that. Can we clarify?
Yeah, so there's SU optional, there's SU required, and then there are things called uncovering. For example, you finish the course, the professor, send a grade to the registrar, and the student at that time can decide whether to use the grade or the SU. So there are sort of three different ways this whole thing can be handled.
I know, but has Cornell adopted?
No, it
has. Is my question.
The only thing that Cornell's actually adopted right now is that it is student-centric. A student can choose SU or letter grade. I don't know about the second part. Please don't take that as any kind of a policy proclamation here.
Is there any news whether summer research programs for undergraduates will be held?
Right now, I think the summer looks like the current scene, right? I think the summer, the first half of summer is, I believe, is going to look like what we have right now. Whether the second half of the summer can open up is a decision is determined by how the pandemic progresses.
Apologies if this has been discussed before, but I'm wondering if for PhD students whose research has been postponed, who may need more time, perhaps it might make sense to not bring in new students next year, so we may fund our existing students more comfortable extending. Oh, and I guess that was one question. And the second question has to do with extending the tenure clock for tenure track faculty. Most of Cornell's peer institutions have done so already by a year.
So for the grad thing, the grad school has a FAQ, and I wouldn't want to try to rely on my memory about what it says about admissions. I believe it's no change, admissions process was launched earlier, and I think it's gonna play out. The tenure clock extension announcement, I haven't read all my mail today, but that's going to be coming out very, very soon from the provost office.
Charlie, I have a question. Is there a plan to deal with this petition that's going around about the universal pass timeline or anything? My understanding is quite a few students have signed it. I also understand that Harvard and Stanford adopted the universal pass today.
We can certainly make it an agenda item for the April Senate meeting. I've seen the petition. I haven't, if faculty write to me about doing something in the Senate, we'll certainly take those steps. Okay. We can have a, if people want to put up a resolution, again, that thing is sort of, that side is still business as usual. We want to have some way of dealing with issues like this and more normal time issues as well. So I have to hear from people directly with proposals, resolutions, and possible agenda items. We can certainly do that.
There's a question here. Jill, are you going to read it or should I read it?
I'll go ahead. Are there signs we can look for to remotely identify students in distress? We had presentations about this earlier this academic year when you can see the students.
I think that's a great question. I mean, I think it's a conversation we've been having at CAPS too. A lot of us feel a little hamstrung not being able to see our students and seeing their body language and their facial expression, things like that. I think for us it'll be helpful when we can do the video conferencing with the Zoom feature. And so I think a lot of those things that, like notice and respond may have presented to faculty on still apply. Some of the obvious, verbalizations, that suggest hopelessness or despair or despondency, things like that. I think in some ways, because we're doing this more remotely, we just need to be more explicit in asking, and just ask, just say, this is a really tough time. There's a lot of stress, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety, how are you doing? And then maybe, and then a lot of times people will say, fine. And I will try to sometimes follow up and say, well, how are you really? ask, and if they say, things are going badly, I would be curious, without being intrusive or nosy, but in the spirit of curiosity, and caring, just really ask, how are things at home? Are they okay? How are things with your family? And then, depending on what the circumstances are, be more explicit, have you been feeling depressed? I wouldn't blame you, are you scared? Depending on what they say, are you having thoughts of harming yourself? I think in some ways we need to be more explicit than we might otherwise under these circumstances and just ask.
What I would add is just look for more students that normally wouldn't contact you, that didn't come to your office hours, those kind of things. They might be reaching out in different ways. And so you might see an influx of students that you didn't communicate on a regular basis now reaching out in different ways. Another way to get to what Wei was talking about is starting your communication with your students, not necessarily about academics, but a commitment of we are in this together. And so one of the things that I would do is start out a class and say, I know this is a transition for all of us. We are in this together. As I try to engage you in an online environment, I want you to know I'm here to support you and understand what you're going through. And with that being said, I want to open up our discussion about how are you doing? How's your environment? Do you feel you're at a place to do your academic work? And that will give a chance to kick off the discussion, not about am I going to pass this test, but let me figure out who you are as a human, and then we can work out the academic aspects of life.
I think that's a really good suggestion. I think prefacing your instruction with that kind of open invitation, just sort of lay it out as an open topic of discussion, and in some ways giving permission and inviting conversation about things other than what's on the syllabus or I think that will hopefully allow students to reach out more. I think the ones I might be a little worried about are the ones who just sort of go below the, beneath the radar. And I think especially, you know, in, you know, working remotely, it might even be easier for students to sort of go below the radar. So the students that kind of like disappear on you and stay out of touch, I might, you know, make a little extra effort reaching out to those guys and seeing how they're doing.
And if you use, I'm sorry, Nima. If you use teaching assistants to break out into the smaller sections or groups, checking in with the TAs, one, to make sure the TAs are okay, but also have they noticed anything different? Granted, everything is different, but if they are able to see, does somebody look, you know, unkempt? Like, I know we can't get to the salon, so hair might be out of the question of judging. But what about their responses? You know, are their responses, are their posts, are they different? Are they sharp? Are they off? And then really, you know, check in and be intentional about that check-in.
We only have 5 minutes left, and I want to actually, you know, this is hard to phrase. I want to actually reach out to all of you. There's more than 50 people on this call, so we're, you know, so this is something that we're all, it touches all of us, right? We're worried about it. And so, and we're also sort of, all of you, all of us are being expected to do extraordinary things, take our classes online in 3 weeks, try and handle all our students. And so, you know, I want to actually make sure that Charlie and I are doing all the things that you need. So if you could, you know, let us know whether we're doing that, that would be great.
Can I actually jump in? I've been, as Charlie and Nima know, I've been jumping into these conversations this week, even on some of the days that weren't actually directly relevant to me. And I have to say it's been extremely, I'm very, very grateful. It's been a way just to, I've been to more meetings this week than I did the entire first 2 months of the semester. And actually, it's been a good thing, which I never thought I'd hear myself say. So I appreciate the series of things that have been put together, and I'm especially appreciative of this one. And I want to thank Nima and Charlie, and also Zeb and Reba and Y, because this has been really, really key and useful and important. And so, yeah, I mean, I appreciate these meetings very much, and I just want to say thank you.
I agree 100%.
Go ahead. I guess I would just say that, I agree with everything Ray just said, and I also this meeting in particular has been useful to me. I've been, you know, learning Zoom basically from scratch, but you know, and that's enough of a learning curve, but I'm more worried about the students than I am about my ability to come up to speed technologically. And so this has been especially helpful to have the opportunity to hear from, you know, Wei and Reba and Zeb about specific strategies that we can use. So thank you for doing it.
Can I ask one thing very quickly, which
can
is-
Can I add something? Oh, yeah, thanks. What I think is also really important about not only these meetings that people have said, but I think it's very important that we as faculty get to talk to each other, because it's not only isolating for the students, but I think it's really isolating for us. So I think that these discussions, even with tons of people, I think they're very, very important. I think we need to be able to ask questions and pose questions and ask how we can participate, you know, even though we're stuck in our homes, in ways that make us part of the discussion. So I think that the usefulness really should be recognized in that way as well. You know, I'm glad we're going to have a faculty senate meeting, because I feel like there's so much that's happening that's really affecting our lives, our students' lives, and policies, that this is also a moment for us to stay engaged with each other instead of, you know, only feel like we are hearing the results. So thank you for this.
Yeah, I agree with that. The shared governance, in fact, is actually more important at these times than during normal times. And we don't, next week, I think our plan is we're just going to have our freeform one on Friday. But if things develop, we can certainly stage it impromptu. But after we get going, Nima and I were thinking that each day, maybe just for a half an hour, we'll pick four people and just say, what was your day like today? Well, how did your class go today? Just have a free form thing like that where people, no agenda, just sort of find out what life is like in the trenches. I think that's going to be really important to have that understanding. So. Okay.
In the student world, there's hashtags, right? Hashtag everything. Some of them, the social distancing has actually taken a turn to hashtag physical distancing, hashtag social deepening.
Right.
And I really like that so much. What Risa said, wow, to see one another and to talk is really helpful. And then my favorite, hashtag stay kind.
Right, yeah. Okay, I think anyone else want to sum it all up? I'd like to, of course, thank our three guests and everyone who participated. And you can always send us questions and whatever. It's very much day by day. But I agree in the last 5 minutes that these things are, what's been said in the last 5 minutes, it's really a nice thing to talk like this and so on. Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody, and we'll be in touch and stay healthy.
Stay kind, as Reba said. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.